History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they don't have to go untold as long as you and I are willing to do something about it. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often, you've heard me say this before, we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 95 years young, and I emphasize young because he's still performing as a percussionist with a band called Memories in the Denver, Colorado area, where Lindy Schala's decades in the construction business have created quite a legacy in brick and mortar. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a photo of Lindy on the porch of the home he built for his family in Greenwood Village. Most of our discussion today, though, will center on points on the map quite a ways from the Rocky Mountains. As a World War II Marine, he saw action on Okinawa and then in China, an area we don't hear all that much about. But Lindy's story starts out on the East Coast. Born in New York City, he grew up in a large Italian family in Paterson, New Jersey.
There were five boys and two girls, and my folks came from Italy. My mom from a little village in the middle of Italy, right near Campobasso, and my dad comes from a village near Naples called, I ought to remember that because that's where they took the surrender, Casa Giove. And that's where it surprised me that they took the German surrender there. But my two older brothers were born in Italy, fought for this country, and weren't American citizens till after the war. And a lot of people don't know this. A lot of guys in that same predicament or category fought for this country. Some got killed, weren't even American citizens. Great many of them. And when a lot of that came out, Mayor LaGuardia was the one that put a big stop to it, because even my mom had to register when the war came along. They were incarcerating the Japanese.
Yeah.
And so they started incarcerating Italian families and German. And like I say, that's when LaGuardia stepped in and said, go ahead and do it. And you'll find out there won't be too many of those kids in the army, because I forgot, it was one of them. He's a pro football player that they did that to, and he said he wouldn't be drafted. So what Muhammad Ali did many years later was done by Gino Marchetti. That's when they became aware the American Armed Forces was greatly supplied with Italian and German surname kids.
And so did you grow up speaking Italian in the home?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, my mom died many years later, I think she knew about three American words, you know. And my dad learned American because he worked in construction. As a matter of fact, they built, a lot of people don't know this, in Paterson, New Jersey, all over New Jersey in that area. There were more test houses that they built to test airplane engines. And from the time, I'd say, even before the war started, you heard of solid drone of motors. And that's why people in that area tended to speak a little loud. I know when my wife met my mother, she said, how come your mother talks that loud? And that's where, during the war, people talked loud, because that drone of engines was going night and day. Believe me, it's one of the great things that people don't realize. Here we were, we start out producing in two countries that had prepared for 20 years. Inside of a year, we were out producing two nations, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was union help. And that's when FDR and the unions made a big stride for their working force in this country.
Well, and I'm just thinking about, I'm imagining what your childhood might have been like in a big Italian family there in New Jersey. I imagine it's maybe different from what kids are dealing with today. What do you remember about your childhood and what life was like for you?
Well, a lot of that. For one thing, we're Italian and Catholic, so I went to parochial schools. Even in the neighborhood I grew up in has a lot of history to Paterson, New Jersey. And Beach Street in Paterson lines up with the airfield where the Hindenburg burned up. And I read that a lot of times in the paper about that being the Hindenburg's maiden voyage, which it wasn't, because we had seen it many times. It lined right up with Beach Street, and our church, every morning we went to church, and then from church we marched over a block to school. And when we saw a lot of Zeppelins, they called them in those days, American-made. But when the Hindenburg came by, God, it was about like three city blocks. It was massive. And I'd always remember that big swastika on the back, you know. But that was at Seagirt, New Jersey. That's where it burned. But a thing that I was never able to really comprehend is how come servicemen, I think it was Navy and all that, would help pull that thing in. But when my dad worked on the Empire State Building, they were thinking very seriously having the mooring at the Empire State Building. When you think about it, that'd have been a real catastrophe, you know, if the Hindenburg had crashed then. But that Empire State Building is still standing today, and being in construction, I see what we built today, and I see even like that building in Miami coming down. You'll wonder, what kind of building is that that comes down? Of course, we've gone to different type construction from right after the war. Precast became very prevalent in office buildings. But those members are made in a factory and then are brought out with a semi and then assembled. And then the latest construction is post-tensioning, which some of the countries, even in Italy, after this was several years ago, some schools collapsed when they had an earthquake. So they quit building schools out of precast, which comes down to it when the best built buildings is reinforced concrete. Just like the Colosseum in Italy, the aqueducts, they're still there, you know, really.
Something we can learn there. And what about all your siblings? Did you guys all get along with each other?
Oh, yeah. My older brother, Johnny, had a scholarship. He was a good student. He could have gone to Rutgers, but my folks couldn't. He had a part scholarship, but they couldn't afford to send him, so he joined the Army. About 1936, he was my older brother. He got out in 39, then the war started, and he got drafted. He's the one that made the landing in Anzio and then got wounded up near Monte Cassino. My brother Matt made the landing at D-Day in Normandy. He was a medic, you know, in the Marine Corps. We call him corpsman, you know, Navy.
And we're going to hear about what you did in the service, too, but I'm curious, too, even before that, the years of the Great Depression, to have a family with that many mouths to feed, I can't imagine it would have been easy.
I'll tell you this. A lot of people don't realize, people from other countries that came with, like my dad, who was a stonemason, carpenters, iron workers, and all that, they're the ones that built this country, believe me. That's why I figured today we should train more craftsmen than lawyers. We don't need any more lawyers, really. That's the way I feel about it. But when you look back, what they did, you know, how this country was built up of people that came from other countries. And you see that today, why, you know, like a lot of these immigrants trying to get here, people don't realize if you lived under tyranny in other countries, like I'm sure I've seen, like in China, you see dead people on the street and all that. And that's why the people that have something to live for want to leave and are open. And mostly after talking to Americans, they like to come and check out our system, you know. But as a kid, I was very lucky. I think I could remember a lot of my friends going to bed hungry, but I'll tell you, I often thought my mom could get a piece of wood and make it taste good. We never went to bed hungry. I'm not saying we ate wood, but my mom can. Even as kids, we go along the highways, collect dandelions. My mom can make a salad out of that, dandelion soup, whatever, you know. People knew how to really make do what they had. And that's why we become the great country we have now. But the sad thing is we become a very violent society. I don't know where that comes from. And maybe the fact that we've gotten away from religion, we've gotten away from patriotism, you know. It's just a different society than when I was a kid, you know.
And speaking of your mom, I mean, I can't let you talk about what a great cook she was without asking what was your favorite Italian dish that she used to prepare.
There were so many that she made. You could always buy beans. Who was it? Louis Prima made this song in it. He talks about pasta fasol, which means beans and macaroni, you know. Yeah. But like I say, anything my mom made or what we drank, or people knew how to make do, really. My mom used to make bread every Friday, so that means Saturday morning she'd have that, some of that bread dough. She made fried pizza, which we ate, like, you put jelly and butter on them, which was very close to what the American people developing pancakes. You know, you had bread. Then at the end of the week, that's where they developed the pizza. But when you had a big family, you know, you used to go on the pizza, the leftovers of the whole week. Really.
Yeah.
And it wasn't very thin crust. It was thick because, you know, that gave you more to chew on, so to speak. But like I say, I never remember going to bed hungry when I was a kid. And out of that same era, you would say, we developed a lot of people that had lent a lot to this country, like athletes, musicians, people that came out of poverty, a lot of baseball players, Joe DiMaggio, Yogi Berra, Dolph Camilli. I can think a whole lot, and a lot of fighters, you know, Rocky Marciano, Graziano, Tippi Larkin. That wasn't his real name, but he was Italian. Yeah, we had a lot of people that became prominent, people of Italian extraction, you know.
I actually wanted to ask you about Joe DiMaggio, because I was thinking, you're growing up in that part of the country when he was such a big deal. Did you ever get to go watch him play?
Oh, yeah. To go to Yankee Stadium, it cost 11 cents. I used to see big bands in New York. You could stand in Times Square. You could see the Strand, the Paramount, Low State. They all had big bands. Floor show, a top movie, cost 25 cents. And sometimes, especially when I played a gig on the weekend, you know, in those days, you played and you made $2. Well, that's pretty big. So you can go to the Paramount and see a band, see the floor show, not even stay for the movie, get another quarter and go to another movie and see another band. I saw Glenn Miller just a couple of weeks before he went into service at the Paramount. And then Benny Goodman, who was known to play Sing, 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 was playing at the big music hall there. What was it? Either Radio City or the, but it cost $1. So I had to wait till he got to the Paramount. It cost 25 cents.
Well, and let me ask you about this first, because you mentioned there playing a gig. How young were you when you got into percussion?
I was the youngest of my brothers, and they had bands, and you play drums, so you don't have to know anything. I was about 10 years old. And we played all the pizza joints in New York and Jersey. And quite frankly, a lot of them were owned by mafia guys. One thing I remember in particular about some of those guys, they all had some real good stories to tell. It was my brother's band, and I remember playing for Frank Sinatra's cousins, the Vigoritos. The mayor of Paterson, New Jersey, was a Vigorito, but they were in politics pretty good. And I remember we played in a place they had rehabbed in the early part, just a little before the war. It was called the Briarcliff Manor, and they even had radio. My wife said she heard it out here, you know. And then when I was, just before I went into service, we were still playing there. Business wasn't too good, because when the war came along, you had to have stamps for gas. And this place was out in the country, in Haledon, New Jersey, out in the country. And business dropped off pretty good. I remember them talking about, well, if business gets any worse, we'll just hit it with lightning. Everybody's thought, well, that's, they're going to refinance. And one night, this Monk Vigorito comes to me, Lindy, don't forget, take the drums home, take the drums home. I said, why? We're going to hit it with lightning. They burned the place down. Yeah, I always remember that. But you know what was funny about that? Many years later, I told my wife about that. We were out in Elitch's. We used to dance there at Elitch's. I said, I got a buddy that plays in the band, and it was Bucky Pizzarelli. He's one of the well-known guitar players, played for NBC and all that. But anyway, we were dancing, and I look up at the bandstand. I see Bucky. I told my wife, my God, there's about four guys in that band that played in our high school band. And during an intermission, they got off the stand, and the one big thing they could remember, hey, Linda, you remember the time Monk told you to take the drums home. they still remembered. Yeah, the Briarcliff Manor in Hailden, New Jersey. Big mansion, yeah.
So you started playing the drums at age 10, and you're still playing them at 95?
Yeah, well, when we get a gig, I'll be real frank with you. When I first came to Denver, I played with some bad bands. I played with some good bands. I was the original drummer in the Queen City Jazz Band. I think they're still, we used to play dances at, well, here, the Legion, just a lot of senior homes and all that. It just seems like either that people don't dance anymore, I guess. We always stayed busy. Sometimes you have several jobs to choose from, you know. And now it's pretty tough to get gigs, like even here, you know. As a matter of fact, I played at Post Number 1 when I first came here. It was on Broadway. And we used to play at least every Saturday, sometimes both Friday and Saturday. And they had nice crowds, too.
And I have to imagine that you wouldn't have been doing that for 85 years if it wasn't something you really enjoy.
To me, music to me is like a therapy, really. I played in some music, like when I was in the first division band, and, you know, some of the sad things you played were when guys got killed. We used to play the funerals. As a matter of fact, the last real big thing I remember, the raid at Taku. As a matter of fact, my daughter got me a book from the library that tells about that raid.
It's time for our first break, so let's save that story for when we come back. 95-year-old Lindy Schala of Greenwood Village, Colorado is our guest today. We'll hear some of his Marine Corps memories from China when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
That music you hear is from the band Memories, with nonagenarian drummer Lindy Schala keeping the beat. Lindy has been drumming since he was 10. He joined the Marines at 17, was with the 6th Marine Division on Okinawa for the final major battle of World War II, but actually had his closest calls well after the Japanese surrendered, or at least what you think of as the Japanese surrender. Because even after that signing of documents aboard the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945, there were still 600,000 Japanese and Korean troops in China. They would surrender in groups over the months that followed. And Lindy Schala was there in Tsingtao on October 25, 1945, more than 2 months after Emperor Hirohito voiced his decision to surrender. On October 25th, the Tsingtao garrison of 10,000 Japanese troops surrendered to the 6th Marine Division. And China would remain very volatile in the months and years that followed as Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists fought for control against Mao Zedong's communist factions. You may not know that nearly a year after that surrender in Tsingtao, in October 1945, 46 now, Marines lost their lives in an ambush on an ammunition dump near the port city of Taku. Lindy, by then a member of the 1st Marine Division Band, was literally caught in the crossfire.
We were on a train coming to play for that people that were, it was part of the 1st Marine Division that were stationed right there when it was either the Chinese, the Nationalists, or part of when we first got to China, it was still probably two or three Japanese divisions. You couldn't tell who was what, but they knew who we were, you know. When they raided that dump, we got caught right in the middle. And as a matter of fact, that book shows a map of the raid at Taku, and it shows a railroad there, but it just shows the railroad right near the ammo dump, but it never tells anything that we were on a passenger car right on that railroad, and we heard the whole thing. So obviously the article on the raid at Taku was written by somebody that wasn't there, because when we were coming in there, because first Divi had one band, used to go all over. We went from Tsingtao, which is a little bit north of Shanghai, and the railroad went from Tsingtao all the way up Tientsin, Peking, a lot of those little towns, Linxi, all the way up to where the Great Wall starts at the sea up at Manchuria. Sometimes we stopped at each post where they had maybe a company of men. As a matter of fact, sometimes we stopped at some of those junctions that just had a couple Quonset huts, one where the guy slept and the other where the mess hall was. We got off the train and played for him. And that's how we got caught there that night there at Taku. And we got it both sides, because we're right in the middle of the two outfits firing at each other when those troops raided that dump. And they killed, I forget how many guys that were guards on there. And then we played the funeral there, which made it a difference. We had a guy in our band. He later started making an announcement for, they called it the North China Marine. It was a radio station, and he used to broadcast to everybody there. We start playing football, and we started 11-man football, but we never got any uniforms. Too many guys got hurt, so they cut it down to six-man touch. And our band officer, Officer Tahasek, we call him a band officer, but we didn't see him that often because he spoke Russian, and he was always interpreting for G2 or G3. I don't know what it was, the intelligence of the Marine Corps. Most of the time, Sergeant Dowdy ran the band, and he allowed us to have a band team. And I've got pictures of that, which shows 1st Divi Band winning the North China Championship. We had two guys that had played college football, Lou Hicks, Bertier, so they weren't just musicians, you know. But one of the biggest games we had was way up there in Chinguantao, right where the Great Wall is. The time we played the 7th Regiment officers, there were troops, you couldn't tell whether they're nationalists or communists, but like flies all along that Great Wall. Really, and here we are playing the game. We weren't concerned, the troops. We had some line outfits there that had rifles, and the band had stacked all their, we didn't carry M1s, we carried carbines. We stacked them on the side, and we were playing the championship game. I even have pictures of it.
You played a football game with spectators on the Great Wall.
Well, they were quite a distance off, but we even had privates there that had field glasses, and they probably thought it was the general or some from the Marine Corps spying on them, and they were looking back, and I guys were laughing, you know. Of course, you get 18-year-old punks could care less, you know, because, hey, the war was over, but they're still more, we saw more raids in China than we did on Okinawa. You know?
Well, and speaking of the raid you were talking about, so you guys are stuck inside this train car the whole time?
Yeah, well, when we came down there, so sometimes we even traveled in cattle cars, which wasn't too hot. They'd have sometimes straw bales. Other times we rode in class. We had coaches that were made in the United States. That night we found out how good those coaches were made, because we were down, most of us, we were shooting craps and we were down below the windows. Were that. And when I think the engineer must have saw the troops going across and he must have cut them off. You know, you could hear the whistle of the train. And then all of a sudden it stopped and we're in utter darkness, but you could hear the either side, Chinese, you know, yelling orders, who knows. We've been drinking a little, but one guy in the band gets his carbine, fires out one side, and that wasn't bad enough. Then he fires out the other side, and we were right in the middle, and we caught hell, but it was all glass. A lot of us got a little stuff from the glass, and apparently they had captured a lot of those Japanese machine guns, which you could hear, you know, Those Nambus were, I think they were 25 caliber. The big difference between ours and theirs is, God, theirs fire so fast. I think they went through a string of 100 rounds and, you know, go brr, brr, and you'd hear them hit the side of the car. But when it hit the glass flew, but it never penetrated the side of the cars. And then we were pretty lucky in that respect. So that's where the, I don't know who came out with that. One of our guys, remember, God protects, what is it, babies and drunks. But as a matter of fact, I got to get that book. My daughter got it from the library about the Marines serving in China from way back, the Boxer Rebellion, all the way to when the communists took over. We left in 47, but there were still troops all the way till 49 when the communists actually took over.
And I know we're bouncing around, but I want to go back a little earlier with you. You talked about your two brothers and what they did in the war. But it seems like most of the guys I've talked to have a memory of when the war started. And I'm just curious for you if there's something that comes to mind when Pearl Harbor Day comes around every year, if you have a memory of December 7th, 1941, and how you found out.
We were at a football game. It was the Yankees and the Dodgers. And I tell people that, and a lot of people don't know that the Yankees had a football team. And the only guy I could remember who played for them was Buddy Young. He was a black guy from Illinois, and the other, who later played for the Patterson Panthers, Ozzie Simmons. But we were watching the game, and then halftime came, and they said, all servicemen, report to your outfits. So there were guys in there and left. And then when we got out is when we found out. We were, I think it was Yankee Stadium. People were saying, Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. Nobody, a lot of people didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Just the smart guys made, like, oh, yeah, you know. Some must have known, you know. But that's where we found out. And then we lived in Paterson, New Jersey then, and the Paterson Evening News had naturally some of the guys from Paterson that were Pearl Harbor, you know. The first guy that I can remember is a kid I went to school with, and I often wonder how the heck he lied to get in the Marine Corps, because he was only maybe a year older than me. But he got killed, Johnny Wardlow, got killed on Guadalcanal, and that campaign was in 42. So Johnny had to lie about his age, and then his folks would have had a sign. But if you look it up, he was one of the first guys in Paterson, New Jersey, to get killed.
How did that affect you? What did that do to your outlook?
A lot of that, you know, there was my brother got called back in the service, and a lot of us, you know, young kids all try to join, but your parents had a sign for you, you know. I didn't go until 44 when you were going to get drafted when you were 18 anyway, so if you joined, you could select the outfit, either the Marine Corps, or the Navy, or the Air Force. But a lot of my friends wanted to go in the Air Force. You know, that was a big thing. I had a friend, Gibb, that was a B-17 gunner. But, it took a lot of buddies. My one buddy, Chippy Yodice, I never could understand that. His dad died when we were kids. We were young. He had about six sisters. His mom raised those six sisters, and damn it if he didn't get drafted. But he got killed at Normandy. He was in a paratrooper, yeah. But it's surprising to me, you know, especially as you get older, you resent some of the guys that didn't serve, like Frank Sinatra, some of the John Wayne, all those guys that used their influence not to serve. You don't think about that when you're young, but as you get older, you think, how the hell did those guys get out of it, you know?
But a lot of the athletes, some of the guys you were talking about earlier, like Yogi Berra, was right there at D-Day with your brother.
Not just him, a guy that I still listen to on, I got a tape of it, Tony Bennett. And I read about Bennett. He was helping some guy, some black guy from South Carolina or something like that. One of the officers reprimanded him for it and put him on some detail, cleaning the outhouses. But he always talked about it. And to me, I still think he's one of the greatest singers. And there's guys, you know, what's happened today, we idolize too many phonies, really. The reason I say John Wayne is when I got out, they were making a movie there at Camp Pendleton, Sands of Iwo Jima. And there was John Wayne there, and then they were staying at the Carlsbad Hotel. I used to sit in with the band there at the Carlsbad Hotel, and old Monty knew we weren't of age. You know, here we're 18 years old, we're combat veterans, and you could drink on the base, but when you went on for Liberty, you had to show your Liberty card. If you, I think you had to be 21. But anyway, he'd sometimes sneak us a drink. So this just before I got out, I told the guys, come on, we were in San Diego. I know the bartender here, he'll give us a drink. And get there, and John Wayne was there, and he said, oh, I can't give you a drink. He said, it's a curfew or something. This guy speaks up. He said, give the boys a drink. It's on me. And I went back to the barracks that morning, and I told the guy, hey, John Wayne bought us a drink. I thought he was a big hero. The guy said, he paid to stay out of the draft. And later I read about him. By God, if he did use his influence so he wouldn't be drafted. And here he made all the war movies like a hero, you know.
And what was it about the Marine Corps? Because as you said, you know, you could have gone for the Navy or the Army Air Corps. You didn't want to wait and get drafted by the Army.
My brother was in the Marine Corps, and he got wounded and got out right at the beginning of the war.
What brother was that?
My brother Al. He was the one 2 years older than me.
I just want to, you know, get the big picture of your family's contribution here. So you said your brother Johnny made the landing at Anzio, was wounded at Monte Cassino. Your brother Matt made the landing at Normandy on D-Day. He was a medic, so he had to take care of some of the worst things. And then your brother Al was a Marine. And where was he wounded?
Early part. He went to the Pacific, but he wasn't in that really that long. From the time he went in to the time he got out of bed, a year didn't go by.
But he's already gone and come back because he got hurt, and you still wanted to do what he did?
Yeah, well, I didn't want to go in the Army, because if I went in the Army, I might have had to go to Italy or something like that. Same with, there was a lot of German kids that wanted to join the Army, yeah, and go shoot their cousin and maybe an invasion of Germany. And that's where the Marine Corps got a lot of those guys. Probably the Navy did, too, or Air Force, or who knows. Yeah. But they knew most of stuff, like the Marine Corps, was mostly Pacific.
What was your welcome to the Marine Corps moment or experience?
I got to be a corporal, and then just a little bit before I got out of, I made sergeant. That was my big rank. Made that when I was in the band. Previous to that, you know, we were pretty, you know, young guys are gung-ho, and that's what the heck they want. You know, we thought we were, me and Nick Trombetta thought we were the two best demolition men in the 6th Marine Division. But there's a lot of things the Marine Corps did for me. I say when I came back, I was on the first football team Camp Pendleton had, because a lot of service teams had teams during the war. And General Erskine, when we came back, there were guys coming in from Seattle and all over trying for that Camp Pendleton team. And at that time, I was in a band. I had a band officer that wouldn't allow us to, any of the guys, me and one other guy, went out for the team. And when he found out, he put a stop to it. But General Erskine put out the order anybody could try. So that's how I got to play football. One of the biggest games we played Destroyer Pacific. That had 4 All-Americans in there. They called it the Service Rose Bowl the year I got out. I think it was, 48. But we played in the Rose Bowl. It was on one of the big holidays. I don't know if it was. We played Destroyer Pacific. And the one All-American I remember later became the something there at Annapolis. He was their quarterback. I don't think it was. It'll come. Let's see.
Well, maybe it'll come to you. But what position did you play?
I was a halfback. Now, guys, I tell guys I was on the first football team Camp Pendleton had, they'd look at you, what the hell did you play? You know, because now the 300-pound guys are quarterbacks anymore. Yeah, really. I kept some of those old programs. I still got some.
So how many seasons did you play for them?
Camp Pendleton won 1948. And then the last game we played a little college there, Oceanside Carlsbad Junior College. And then about 6 of us from that Camp Pendleton team played on Oceanside in 49. The year we played them when I was Camp Pendleton, the quarterback for Oceanside was Jamie Russell. You remember Jane Russell? That was her brother. She was married to Waterfield, who was a quarterback for the Rams. But Jamie Russell was a good tall kid. And my one famous thing, I intercepted one of his passes, which we helped win the game. They were marching, and I think they would have scored. And he had this guy who was pretty fast, as Jimmy Riddle. I always remember his name because he ended up playing for the Rams. I knew what they were after, and I know he went back and told them I could beat this guy, you know. So, but he did, and I intercepted his pass. That was my one famous thing that I ever did.
Well, you got a lot of things going on here, but one more question about when you played Destroyer Pacific at the Rose Bowl. I was just at the Rose Bowl, and there were 50,000 people there. So it makes me wonder, what was the crowd like when you military teams played?
They probably had about that many because those service games were free.
Well, what was that like to play in that venue?
Oh, that's, you know, the only crowd I ever played was in high school, and even then we played at Hinchcliffe Stadium in Paterson, New Jersey. But that Rose Bowl was a big I think I just played defense there on the Camp Pendleton team.
And we've talked about a lot of things, and I talked about why you wanted to go into the Marine Corps. But what about when you were shipping out? Did you have an expectation? Were you concerned about being in combat? Were you looking forward to it? What do you think was going through your head?
You know, young punks, we couldn't wait to get in combat. It's a good thing, though, like I said, they dropped the bomb and that. But then we saw more, actually, action in China.
Which is an eye-opening reality that I'm sure some of you are learning about for the first time today. It's break time again, but there's more to come with 95-year-old Marine Corps veteran Lindy Schala of Greenwood Village, Colorado. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 95-year-old Lindy Schala, recorded at American Legion Post 1 in Denver, Colorado, where he has given more than a few concerts with his band Memories. Once a drummer, always a drummer. And once a Marine, always a Marine. We heard about how he survived the raid on an ammunition dump near Taikoo, China, a year after World War II officially ended. But as an 18-year-old in 1945, he also saw action in the final major Pacific battle, Okinawa.
Yeah, but we didn't see much there. Big stuff was done, and they took prisoners, you know, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, like even I got a neighbor that's a retired general, and when I told him we were in China, I was in China from 45 to 47, he couldn't believe it. He said, I'll have to look it up. And I thought, well, take my word for it. I wasn't asleep for 2 years.
Well, and that's where I want you to help us out, because like you say, a lot of people don't know that. And even the stuff that was happening in the heart of the war, China's always overlooked because they talk about Europe and they talk about the Pacific Islands, but General Chenault was over there and Stilwell was in that theater, and then you had the Seiko groups working with the Chinese. So help me understand what you experienced when you got there and what were some of the things you guys in the Marines had to do.
Well, for one thing, and I look back at this, a lot of the common people didn't care for Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek, that government, if they'd have treated people halfway decently, not like slaves, Mao Zedong would have never. But Mao did more against the Japanese with captured American equipment that we were furnishing the nationalists. And at the particular time when we were there, you didn't know who the hell you were drawing fire from, whether it was the nationalists trying to get us involved. It's a good thing. I always look back at this. It's a good thing we had a bright guy like Harry Truman. Harry Truman knew what war was about, and he was able to decipher that the nationalists were trying to create incidents because There's times shells were lobbed over when we were in Tinson. You didn't know who fired them, really. Especially guys that make excuses. They can't hit anything because a lot of them got that Japanese stuff that they captured, you know. But we were like in a quagmire, really. And it's a good thing Truman just said the hell with it, pulled out. Because if the people really wanted Chiang Kai-shek, if he'd have treated people halfway decently, I look at, from what I read later, Chiang Kai-shek at first overthrew a lot of the warlords, and that's how he got popular. But then he married into the Sung family, which was Madam Chiang. She was used to living like in royalty. She used to come here to the United States and give Mrs. Roosevelt a hard time staying in the White House or wherever they stayed. She had to have silk sheets every day and every night, you know. Like I say, she wasn't aware or didn't think she had to do anything for the common people. I was very lucky in that respect. I had a house boy. We call old Hogue boy. Here we were, well, I was 18, yeah, and Hogue was probably 50 years old. He could have a conversation just like we're having here. He had been trained by the Jesuits there, and I could talk to him, you know, and I'd, hey, Hogue, what's going to happen when we leave? And he'd say, well, you know why people are going to accept the communists? Because we're living like slaves now. Here was a guy, he had a family and all that. You know, I'd go around and get some of the guys, come on, you can give more than a dollar. You know, everybody pitching a buck to give the guy, and you know. And I was always trying to get him more money, and he appreciated that. And I learned a lot about what was happening, truthfully, you know. And he helped me a lot. I didn't smoke, and you could buy cigarettes at the PX, a carton, 50 cents. And Hogue introduced me to the rich Chinese that would spend $20 for a carton. And then he even knew a lot of rich Russians. And I made some bucks. I always remember when I came home, my mom remarked, she said, I didn't know a corporal made that much because I used to send money home. But I never regretted that. A lot of guys say, oh, you pulled a lot of crap. Like, well, I saw some of the big officers must have been tapping something in the QM, because half the time you couldn't get any American toilet paper, but you'd go to the Chinese stores and buy toilet paper. We had to use that Chinese toilet paper. They still didn't know how to make paper. It still had splinters in it. Really? Yeah, yeah. And just a lot of stuff, you know. I look back at what happened. Some big officers made some pretty big money, really.
And as far as, you know, the purpose for you Marines being there, a lot of people don't realize, and still to clarify, this is after Japan has surrendered, but you guys are in China, and you still are in situations where you could lose your lives, where you're in danger.
I got pictures of when we took the surrender. I tell Jim, my neighbor, who's a retired general, you know, everybody thought the surrender was when MacArthur took the surrender on the Missouri. We got into China, and we had a surrender in Tinson. I got pictures of it. Guys that I knew that were intelligence that gave me those pictures. As a matter of fact, when General Rocky took the sword from the Japanese general, the Japanese do an about-face when they throw their foot out, and I think he thought the guy was trying to kick him, and he dropped the sword, you know. I got pictures of that. A lot of things that I can really remember is here we were concerned with playing football, and here was at night, especially we're at even Pedaho Beach. Pedaho was where the rich Chinese had big houses on the ocean. I got pictures of us practicing there. There's a big lighthouse near there. I got pictures of that. And that wall, that Great Wall of China, was just swarming. And who the hell knows what kind of troops, you know.
I think you've got to be the first guy I've ever met, maybe the only guy in the world, who's played football in the Rose Bowl and in front of the Great Wall of China.
Yeah, well, I never thought of that, but that's right, we did. And especially the real game was, see, the officers didn't care for the band winning. And Ken McKenzie, he was North China Marine. He got on and he said, the band is traveling. They're going from Tinson all the way up to Tsinghuantao, and they challenge any team in North China. And we played a couple army teams. And then by the time we got to Tsinghuantao, who was it? The 7th Regiment officers all got together and informed we're going to beat them. But we beat them. Later, I knew, because when I played for Camp Pendleton, but Zutke and I forgot the other officer, that said, you guys had a hell of a team there, that band team. And I said, well, we had two guys that had played college ball. The rest of us just played high school, you know. But this one guy, Winchell, who later played for Kentucky, Harry Winchell, he devised things, you know, for six-man touch. Ended up to be a pretty rough game because the blocking was pretty furious, you know. And when it wasn't just touching, it wasn't tackled. They tried tackling, too many guys got hurt, no equipment, you know. But it was a neat thing. I still got pictures of us posing, you know, with a football that we made. Had the thing, North China Champions. It was one of the great things that I remember in the Marine Corps. But then another thing I remember, how much the guys appreciated when we'd get the band, you know, the marching band. But with the troops, really, sometimes we go to the Quonset huts, three or four pieces, and just play music for them. They liked that better because we played some of the dance music, you know.
I have the feeling you have a million more stories, and I don't want to leave anything important out. But I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story nobody else could tell us. When you think about what you and all your brothers did in World War II, what's the significance of that in your mind? Is there some pride you take from that?
Yeah, you know what you really think of? How many people that were not American citizens like we were, the rest of us that were born here, but guys like my brother, and a lot of people know this, a lot of those guys came from other countries, got killed fighting for this country. And there were a lot of guys like that. And it all happened when they start incarcerating the Japanese. And one of the biggest things, you know, from the time you go to boot camp, now we didn't know any Japanese. When we were kids, we saw a few Chinese that had laundries, but the Japanese were maybe on the West Coast, they saw them, you know. But when after the war, I went to a little school there, Oceanside. About half the student body were Japanese kids. I played with Georgie Nakano. I played football with him on the Oceanside team, and George was in that outfit that fought in Italy, that Japanese outfit that was...
The 442nd.
Yeah, and I could kid with him because there were times he used to yell out something in Italian, and I'd say, George, when I yelled Banzai, you know, you charge, and we could kid around like that, but I met some of the nicest Japanese kids. As a matter of fact, I had a girl, but it just shows how, you know, just getting around helps you be more tolerant of people, you know, because especially I think sometimes the news media creates a lot of animosity.
And at 95, you're still drumming. How long are you going to keep doing that?
Until I can't drum anymore. I got arthritis in my hands, but I try to do exercise every day. When you play music, it comes back to you, you know. It's part of your life, especially when we were kids. We used to shine shoes, and I could really make the rags pop, you know. And then I found out some of those guys, you shine shoes, my brother showed you. I play the harmonica and you dance. And so we thought we were big dancers too, you know. So music been part of our lives for a long time, you know. Even today, it's a real therapy.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you think is important for us to know?
Well, truthfully, I think the most important thing that I'd try to get across to people is about, like, guys like my brother that fought for this country. They were lucky they came back, and there were a lot of guys you never heard of got killed fighting for this country. And that's what really tease me off when I see guys that people admire that use all their influence to get out and not serve in a service. And a lot of that animosity comes as you get older. You know, I never thought about that when I was younger. Yeah, well, you see guys like young guys that got killed, buddies of mine that got killed, you know, and here's especially some of these people that people admire. There's a lot of things that, you know, people write about, that they write about things that they don't know anything about. And it's sad, really.
I just realized what I didn't ask you about, your late wife, Margaret, and how you met. And that story goes all the way back to your time in the Marines because you were friends with her brother?
He asked me, where are you from? I said, New Jersey, born in New York. I said, where are you from? He said, Denver, Colorado. I said, where the hell's that? It's still stuck with my kids. If you ask them now, yeah, Uncle, I said, you didn't even know where Denver was, which I didn't, you know. But he had, after they dropped the bomb, then they let a lot of the married guys out, you know. I didn't come back till 47. That's when I met my wife. As a matter of fact, she worked at Bodefeld Cleaners right there on Broadway, and I remember late at night, and they had to go in to check something. And I walked them, she and her sister, to Bodefeld Cleaners, you know. But then I came back. I had a football scholarship at DU, which I never played a game. Because by the time the season started, I got called back for the Korean War. I never went to Korea. I went. Somebody said, hey, don't worry about it. Camp Pendleton going to have a football team. And I had played at Pendleton before I got out. I'd get you on it. And, oh, it was Joe Kerberry. He was a captain. He played center on a Camp Pendleton football team, and he had played at DU. But a couple of days later, I met Andy Olasek, who was a sergeant in the band, in the 1st Divvy band, and he told me the same thing, and he pulled me out, and I got in the band at Pendleton. That helped me from not going to Korea, even though they were taking some guys. My luck held out, and then I got out, you know.
With Ed, with your wife's brother, did you say he was in the Merchant Marine?
Yeah, he was an emergency marine, and he was talking about a convoy going to Guadalcanal, and they spotted submarines, how they went in on pins and needles, you know. Because at that time, the Japanese were fairly good. They weren't as good as the Germans with their subs.
And so when you knew him over there, did you know about his sister? Did he show you pictures or anything?
Well, yeah. I was mailman for our outfit, and I always remember some big envelopes, and I say, Ed, who the hell are you? Is that your wife? He said, no, that's my sister, Margaret. She likes to write, which she did. My wife was a real letter writer, you know. When I came to see Ed, that's when two sisters, Jess and Margaret, were working at Bodefeld, and I came to see Ed, and he said, I got to walk my sisters up to Broadway, which I did, and that's where I met my wife. A couple of years later, we got married.
And they were in their 70th year of marriage when Margaret passed away in 2020. You'll find a photo of Lindy and Margaret as newlyweds, as well as other snapshots of Lindy from his football and Marine Corps days and his continued exploits as a drummer at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.